Hi, I'm Mark Lynch, Director of the Project on Middle East Political Science. Welcome to the Middle East Political Science Podcast. On this week's episode, we're joined by Sami Hermez of Northwestern University in Qatar and Serene Sawala, authors of the new book, My Brother, My Land, A Story from Palestine, just published by Stanford University Press. And this is a bit of a departure for us here at the Middle East Political Science Podcast. This isn't a political science, but it's an incredibly interesting, to me, it seems like a nonfiction narrative or narrative nonfiction, which Sami and Serene together produce. And I want to hear from you kind of what the story's about, how you came to write it, and what you think we learned from this style of writing and research. Perhaps we could start with Sami just giving us a brief synopsis of the scope of the book. And then Serene, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how it evolved. Sami?
Mark, yes, Mark, thank you very much for having us on. And it's a real honor to be on this podcast. So this book, we started this book 20 years ago, actually, when the two of us first met. And I'll let Serene say more about that. But the book basically is the story of Serene and her family, and her brother, who was in the resistance, Palestinian resistance, with at one point with Islamic Jihad, and it begins actually, interestingly enough, with Serene and her mother and two of her sisters actually outside Palestine in 1967, during the 1967 war. And actually, as it says at the in the blurb, they walk back against the traffic of exile, with her mother really refusing to want to be displaced and want to be a refugee in that war. And so the story begins, and it goes through their life. But we decided to assemble this and weave this together in a way. As you said, narrative nonfiction, creative nonfiction, where what I normally say is basically this: it's a story of a life that will tell itself, or is meant to tell itself, if it's done well, at least. And as I say, free of explanation. So Walter Benjamin says of the novelist, is someone who is supposed to tell a story free of explanation. And I think as a social scientist, as an anthropologist, there was this kind of need or will to always want to explain. And I can talk about that a little bit more later. But the story is this, a narrative, a creative narrative that, I always also say that it has drama. There's suspense, so you technically don't know what's going to happen, unlike your traditional kind of academic monograph, where you tell people the story right at the beginning. So yeah, I think maybe Serene could, if you want to jump in, to say a little bit more about the story, about the book.
Serene, please.
Yes, hi, Mark. I hope you will enjoy the book when you finished, and I hope all your audience will get the chance to read it and learn about the struggle of one single Palestinian family from a small village. Most of the maps are even that village, not like the name of the village will be not in a few, maybe two or three maps in the world. But I feel like since I was young, I always liked to tell the story, and I feel like people did not have enough stories about the Palestinian struggle. So whenever I meet anybody in the U.S., I felt like it's a burden in me when I moved to the U.S. Whenever I meet anybody, as soon as they ask me from my accent, where are you from, and I say Palestine, right away, I want to tell the whole Palestinian story. So I was fortunate that I met Sami. He just moved into his graduate school, and I'm a mother of three children. But in the same time, as soon as I moved to the area from New York City to Princeton area, I made sure to attend lectures, workshop, speakers about Palestine, protests too. So when I met Sammy right away, anybody I see, like we talks, and I was glad that he got interest in the story. But in the same time, I feel there's so many stories about Palestinian diaspora, Palestinian becoming refugee in 1948, Palestinian becoming refugee in 1967. But growing up all my life, whatever my mom had hardship, she will remember how she walked back, how she was caring about keeping the land, the olive trees, the house, and stay in touch with her family. So she just left to Amman, Jordan, to go visit my father in Abu Dhabi. But then 6 Day War happened, and she made a decision. I mean, it impacted all of us. It impacted all of us. It was a big deal. It impacted us, impacted her, and impacted my dad too. And it's kind of that decision is that like every one of us has different path in their life because of that decision. In the same time, the book will talk about, it's not just, yeah, the Palestinian struggle. It talk about childhood memories, a meal I had, a joke, a story I told him when we were young, keeping my grandmother and my grandfather and all my uncle and cousins' stories in alive. And I always tell people we live to tell, and the Palestinian, each one of us has one story different than the others, but I feel it's unique about us, and it's time to keep telling it. Keep telling it. So that's how I always talk about it. Yeah. And Sammy did it the way he did it, by keeping my voice, which is we recorded and we made days and days to record my voice and how specifically I wanted that voice to stay. And some details were matter for me, and maybe Sammy will talk about the editing process. But in the same time, there are so many details I want to keep them because they will paint the full picture for everybody who read the book. How is this small village in Kufurai face the occupation?
And that was very interesting, actually. The way that you have both the narrative, the narrator's voice, but also the excerpts of your own voice. And that was an
Yeah.
interesting decision. Maybe you should talk about that a little bit at this point.
Yeah, I struggled with this quite a bit, trying to figure out how do we weave this together, this story. There was a lot of this was based on Celine retelling that I think, as she was saying, when we first met, I was a first year student at Princeton, and it was amazing the way she could tell a story. In Arabic we have this character of the Hakawati. Right, so Hakawatiya, the storyteller, right? And so she's a storyteller, an oral storyteller, but then at the same time, there's a huge difference between the oral storytelling and the written text, and those are really two different genres, right? It's like someone who's a poet then writing fiction, right? Like those are different genres, and they're hard to sort of combine. And so I really wanted her voice to somehow come. I was actually at some point really obsessed with not wanting to change a single word that she said, which was very difficult, right? And I was also feeling like the written was not going to capture her whole essence. And so we kind of sort of came to this sort of, I don't want to say, I'm not sure if it's a compromise, but came to this set, we settled on this, right? That if we can have both of our voices. And it's interesting because I don't think Sidian knows this, but a lot of the reviews that came back of the book Before it was published, people really liked her voice. Reviewers liked her voice, and so I was really happy about that and the switching, because I think that was I was always afraid if that would work. And this is also the last thing I'd say on this is that the oral history genre usually has like a narrator or someone who's like the analyst and then the person who's telling the story. And those two things are usually very separate. And it's like, now I'm going to, I interviewed this person and then and then you sort of let them tell the story. And here there was more of a joint storytelling that I was trying to do. So kind of like we're in conversation.
Yeah, it's quite innovative, and I think it works quite well. Serene, though, there are moments in the story, obviously, which are very dark, very, very difficult. The times when Yad is in prison, the incidents with the collaborators, the end of the story. It must have been difficult to bring that out and to confront it all head on, and kind of tell. It's very clear that you were trying to. Tell the unvarnished truth about what it was like living under occupation and the hard choices that imposed on so many people.
It's even not just that. It's hard to, as a small village I think when I was growing up, around less than 6,000 people living there. Half of them live in Kuwait, Jordan, and the Gulf. And for my mom, as this woman who's raising a big family by herself, it's hard even to give her lifestyle. Like there's so many things is there for her. It's a secret. It's like how she managed this house, how she was working in the land and taking care of us, how even she prepared a meal and feed. There is topics I talked about. It's very sensitive for my mom, and I think I keep telling Sammy, she just turned 18, March 30. God bless her, 80 years old. And I keep telling Sammy, I don't know when she read the Arabic version, how she will respond to so many of the stories I told. Even discipline, treating us, but all of that, because she has this big responsibility raising this family by herself, again, under the occupation. But at the same time, for me, those little stories are dear to my heart. Like Sammy said, I cannot tell a story without the little details and my feeling and the people around me feeling how when this happened, how what happening. So there is many times while Sammy shared the story with me, I would say, no, just can we keep that line? Can we edit this? I remember this. And he accommodates so many times, and then so many times the editor will come back and says, no, we need to remove this part. But we ended up in all the book talk giving me the door or the chance for me to express whatever was missing or we could not fit in the book. So I literally took that opportunity. I would be driving and I would remembering some details and I would call Sammy right away, like, oh, I remember this. Can we add it to that chapters? There is time while I did not want this chapter after this chapter. I wanted before it. So there is like many times he gave suggestion and they were great. And in the same time, I don't know, like Sammy said, Hakawati, there is so many details I would like to observe from our history and culture as Fallahi, we call it, as people who lived in the village. And it was not easy for me to let go of that. In the same time, talking about Iyad, the prison visits, the struggle he went through, it's remind me daily of all the thousands of Palestinians who still in prison. And there is so many of them, nobody's going to write their story. So I feel like it's not just a story of Iyad, it's a story of all Palestinians who tried to fight the occupation and resistance, and then how they ended up in prison for years and years. And some of them, we forget them. We forget them. They spent, I mean, with Iyad, 210 years was sentenced. So yeah, just another little story comparing to the big one. It's every time Sammy sent it to me to edit it, I will hesitate for a couple of hours or a day or two. I don't want to read it because it brings me to tears every time I read it. There is so many sad or parts from my my family life, even when we read it or we talk about it in an interview, it takes me 2 3 days to get over it. So it's not easy to talk about it. Like I was in Ramadan iftar the other day, and they asked me to say something about the iftar and the community, and I said it's Ramadan fourth. And suddenly, while I'm in the middle of the speech, I remember what's Ramadan fourth for me. I totally forgot until I was in the microphone. And then people sitting there, I did not want to say about my Eid and what happened in Ramadan and the fourth day of Ramadan, but it brought me to tears, and people are listening to me, not understanding why she's crying suddenly. And then it just, I remember what happened that night for us and my family. It changed all our life. Yeah. So,
You
and then
know,
from, oh, go ahead,
I
please,
didn't
Samir.
realize. Yeah, I was just gonna say, even myself, I didn't realize because, you know, a lot of this work was done long distance, right? The first 2 years I was in Princeton. Celine reminds me that we used to meet like every Wednesday to do these recordings, but then I left and I went and I did, you know, my dissertation work and stuff. And, you know, there was a time where I sort of left the project, but then when we came back, a lot of it was on WhatsApp and we would and phone calls and so on. And so I didn't, and then I would send her the drafts of the book, and I didn't realize, you know, that some of these drafts, some of the pages, some of the chapters would make her cry. But of course, I had no idea, you know, because I'm over here. And when we were doing some of the book talks, I realized, you know, some of these things really, you know, elicit great pain and emotion, which obviously, you know, I mean, it's not surprising, but at the same time, you know, you forget at a distance, of how these things play out. Yeah.
So the genre that this, you know, most I think comfortably fits in for me is less oral history and more the kinds of biographies which are used to tell the story of a city or a country or an institution. I think like Robert Caro's books or that sort of thing. And that very much is, I think, what readers will get. I mean, certainly they'll get, you know, the intimacies of the family and what it's like to, you know, kind of be raised in a village in Palestine in that way. But you're also telling a big story about the transformation of Palestinian society, life under occupation, and a story of what drives or what brings an individual like Iyad to resistance and the path from being, you know, being kicked out of school to Fatah to Islamic Jihad. And I wonder if you could, you know, since this is a political science podcast, maybe if we could like go up that ladder a little bit and talk about some of the broader narrative of Palestinian history, which you think the story you're telling elucidates. Sammy, you could start.
Yeah, I think for me, this story, one of the things I was hoping to put out there, and why I found that Celine's story and her family's story is so important, is that it's also about, as she said, a small village. And a lot of Palestinian narratives that we get and stories and even analysis, right? Political science and whatnot. It usually is about the larger cities, or the larger towns. So if you leave Ramallah, it's about Jenin or Nablus, right? Or Jerusalem. It's about the city centers, and about the nobility, right? The notables. And here you have a family that is of they're farmers. They're from a small village. And so you have a different, you know, sort of class element that we don't normally see. But also that they're not, yes, they're refugees, but they're taking ownership of their lives, you know, they're some in the family are fighting back, or each is, you know, fighting back in their own way. So there is that element, and then I think, as you said, I wanted to show that transformation. So this sort of history and politics through a story, through this family and how it impacts this family. Essentially, I go back maybe away from the political science, but I wanted, I think we both wanted people to sort of feel, right? To feel something, because it's when you feel you act, right? And so that was also part of the motivation, at least for me.
But I think one of the things which gives it power is that it's not just telling kind of a simple hero and villain narrative of, kind of noble Palestinians and evil Israelis. This is a complex life that you and that Serena and her family were navigating, and the chapters about collaborators and kind of early in Iyad's political life, those were very searing chapters, and put a kind of a less pleasant face on what resistance means. And I was curious, Serene, when you were remembering this, and that especially because this is not just someone that you're writing about, it's your brother.
Tell you the truth, I always say it all. That's what it happened. I cannot make my brother the hero. And like you said, this is what was going on. And the people in small villages, like my villages, barely have maybe one or two TV channels, maybe two, three radio station only when I was growing up, even two station,
But they
right?
read the paper religiously. I love that detail,
Right?
the way they
The
read the
newspaper come on
newspapers.
so weak, and we really were hungry for information. So to show that those young boys did not have any instruction, any leaders. They were, I remember one say from Iyad, every time he was getting in trouble and my mom asked him to come back and settle down and stop doing what you're doing, he will say, "You're greedy. You have 13 children. You don't want to sacrifice one of them to this country." So this is how he looked at it. It's like, I'm here, I want to do whatever I can for my country. And suddenly I felt Iyad grew so fast before he even growing, like from his burden that this is his country. He doesn't care about school. I think the only reward for him to see Palestine is free. And whatever bad anybody will tell him about, he will follow without even doubts. So for him is a young boy, no education. Like for me, I left to Jordan, from Jordan to New York, and then I have my children. I have my graduate degree. I was able to have an eye opening to what's going on in around the world. But for Iyad, he's in a small village, and all he's following up whoever gonna make him the person who's gonna free Palestine one day. So he is carrying different paths in his own. So it was very difficult, but in the same thing, I cannot deny his faults. Faults, like everybody has his different side of his life. And for me, as much as I love my brother, and for me, he's a hero, this is the truth. This is his life. This is what he did. This is the decision he took in life. And later on, he reflected on those decisions. He learned from them too. And that's why when he was young, I'm talking about 13, 14, 15 years old, following Fateh Bialo, Bialo, and then when he went to prison, he got different education, different perspective. So he was a kind of mold in prison. So all his idea, and yet I could not know, came out after his death, like because I learned so much about him later on. So tell you the truth, like the prison was the first and the last school for political for Iyad, and to send him different path in his life. And I feel not just him, a lot of prisoners. And let me correct that, not just politics and religion. Religion. I think a lot of Palestinian young boys, when they enter prison, they take the Quran. He took it really seriously. He understood it and translated in his own. And we got so many of his notes when from prison, and I could testify to that. So religion and politics impacted Iyad life in prison differently than before prison. So for as a young boy, it was not easy for him to make any decision. He was following. But later on, he became the leader, and people are following him. So his lifestyle changed in the year he sent in prison.
And one of the things which is
Yeah.
really interesting in that story is that typically your brother's story would have been told as one of radicalization, but that's not at all the way it's presented. It feels more like a story of maturation and kind of growing into a leadership role, responding to the realities around him, which again, if you put on, your political science hat or your anthropology hat, it's a very different way of thinking about what is happening to these young men in prison. It's not about radicalization. It's not about extremism. It's about kind of political education. It's quite interesting. And again, maybe that's one of the things you can see through a narrative that you couldn't see through a more traditional kind of social science approach.
Right. Like, if I remember from visiting, every time we visit, his family is allowed once a month, two people at a time. There is time what it take 5 6 months for that person to visit him again. So if I visit this month with one of my sister, next month other two sister, and then other two brother or my mom and dad. So for us, we barely saw him, but in the same time, he was looking forward once a month for this visit. And then many times curfew happened and this visit were canceled. There is a time period where like 6 months, nobody visit. And there is prisoners who spend even years. This time for somebody between four walls under the occupation is going to be what? Spending either religion or reading politics or speaking with other prisoners. So those become the family for him. And those are become the educator for him. And they mold him and he mold them in a different way. So he impacted them, they impacted him. And that's how prisoners, and remember, he was what, 17, 18 years old, a very young boy, never left Kfar Ra'in. I mean, my first time leaving Kfar Ra'in to Jordan when I finished high school for college. So this is very important to look at it. And then for me, I look at my younger brother. He lost his childhood. He lost his youth behind bars. And I still remember first visit, how he talked to me 17 days in interrogation as a young boy who like no family, no familiar faces in front of him under torture for 17 days, no eating, no sleeping. That's impacted him mentally. I impacted Iyad. And Iyad did not talk about those years when later on in his life, yeah, as all other prisoners, which is, I was talking to somebody the other day about what we're seeing now released about prisoners from Gaza, and that person was in prison in the 90s. Says we have wars, but people, they're shy, they're scared, their bride will not let them release all these tortures. They faced in prison, and their shame of what happened to them in prison. So when they come out, they keep it inside and they don't talk about it.
Wow,
And this is
interesting.
always a question in my mind, how Iyad dealt with it. And I could see from his behavior after that, he had a lot of anger inside him. And I don't like, it's very difficult to get to a Palestinian young man or woman who spent years in the under the occupation prisons, how they felt, and they will they be talking about it, and hopefully more will talk about it even than what we talked about it with a book with Iyad.
Sami?
You know, there's yeah, there's three things, you know, sort of other things that I think we were both hoping to get out, you know, get across in the story. I think Serene mentions one is sort of the prison experience. The other thing is the degree to which collaborators have infiltrated society, or how the Israeli state and regime has worked on this question of collaboration and how this kind of this works. And even for me, when I was there, I remember it was amazing, like how much there's talk about who is and who isn't a collaborator. And you know, of course, you just never know. And I think that's an element to the story of sort of an undercurrent that's going on. And the third thing is this idea that resistance, you know, you were talking about this theory of like radicalization, right? As if, you know, and when you say radicalization is something inherently bad, right? To and that, you know, that people would not resist settler colonialism, would not resist apartheid or occupation, or call it what you want to call it, but who would, that they wouldn't resist, and that they would resist in all kinds of ways, whether the three of us like it or don't like it. We might like some ways and not like other ways. Maybe even, while people are doing things, they aren't necessarily, thinking about all the A to Z and dotting the I's and crossing the T's of what they're doing. And that, the stuff happens, right? And so how, how do you tell that story? I choose my means, but so that, I think that was also a difficulty, because of course this particular issue of Palestine is so fraught and so contentious, and you can't say anything without being attacked, and so how do you approach this topic in a way where, no, I'm not going to say that, what this was, right or wrong or whatnot, right? So, or call it terrorism or whatnot, and that doesn't mean I agree or I would, so
Sure.
it's those kind of issues were sort of hard to
But what's interesting,
articulate.
Sammy, is that the nature of the story almost tells it determines, kind of the takeaways. In other words, it's not a theory driven, it's an experience driven thing. And so there's a big debate, for example, in political science about whether extremism is driven by ideology. Like, does becoming more religious and all that, does that make you more likely to be violent? But this story says, well, that's not what happened here. This was very much about, kind of an escalating resistance to occupation under different conditions. Yes, he became more religious in prison, but that's not what caused his, move to Islamic Jihad. You mentioned in there about a lot of the Islamic Jihad kids were not particularly religious, but the leadership figured they could mold them as they came in. But again, that's actually telling a causal story in a way that you can only maybe do it through this kind of narrative approach.
And it's really difficult because, we all have our views, right? And our politics and stuff, and even our theories, right, about why these things happen. And so it was hard to do it without like wanting to tell you what I think, or to provide the analysis, because, I don't want you thinking in one direction. But then, so then I had to disabuse myself of that and say, okay, you know what? Some people are going to think this, and some people are going to think that, and some people are going to interpret it this way, and others will interpret it that way, and it is what it is, and and try to sort of remove myself. But that was also another thing, as early versions, I had a bit more of myself in there, and then the press actually came back to me and said, you either need to have more of yourself or remove yourself. A lot more, because I appeared from now every now and then, and I felt that if I always, this was from the very beginning, I always felt like I didn't want this to be about, this is not about me. And in anthropological texts, normally, the anthropologist puts themselves front and center, and you have to talk about your positionality and, all your feelings and how this has affected you, and so then it becomes about you. As much as anthropologists maybe don't want to make it about themselves, it, there's becomes a big part becomes about themselves, and I didn't want that, so I ended up removing, so I appear at the beginning and end, and there's one chapter with Sirin and I were walking in Kfar Rae, and she's talking to me about what's going on, and
But otherwise, you pretty much removed yourself.
yeah.
But it's interesting though, because like I said, I mean, I feel like this is a case where the story, in a sense, doesn't tell itself, but it does have its own truth. I remember, listening to a fiction author once talking about the process of and how frustrated she got with her characters because she wanted them to do something, but they wouldn't let her because That's not how they would behave. It just wasn't right. It didn't ring true. And in a sense, the disciplining nature of a good narrative, in a sense, might actually be a good corrective to what we often do as social scientists in terms of imposing theory onto facts.
Yeah, no, and it's I think part of it, there were parts, right, that also, the gaps where Serene did not know, right, or could not know about his life, for example. And so how do you, sort of treat that, and the limitations, as you said it really well in terms of, what he could and could not do. Right. And the other thing was also the I didn't there were parts where I didn't want to expose the family, right? So Serene told me a lot more than obviously we write about. And she was we were joking because someone else for another visit, they were asking a question about, like, did Serene have a veto? Kind of, was there a deal, like, where Serene could veto? And I laughed because I felt like, I feel like I'm the one who had to veto because she wanted to put everything in there, and so I had to realize at one point, I'm not trying to expose their family or even sort of put people in a bad light, but at the same time, I wanted these people are not, as Sydney was saying, nobody's a hero, right? We all have our faults. I have my faults. You have your faults, right? And so, how do you tell a story where people, in some ways, are meant to be heroes, right? Like, you're Palestinians. We want them to either be heroes or, victims. And there's, like, they can't be anywhere in between, right? And so it's tough.
I think two of the moments of uncertainty that really stuck with me were the with the collaborators, and maybe someone gets killed and no one actually knows whether they really were or weren't a collaborator, and being honest about that is fascinating. And then the story of Iyad's wife, and well, what really happened with her? Why did she disappear? Why did she come back? And just being honest about being uncertain about that and not knowing was I think that was a really interesting and I think a good kind of storytelling choice. Serene, before we go to the break, can you like maybe sum up, very briefly, what is the big thing that you would hope that readers would take away from your family story as they as they contemplate Palestine? Like, what do you hope they learn about the Palestinian experience from your story?
I feel like with what's happening lately, people could learn that this has been happening for since 1948. Okay, this is not something just they heard it in the news, October or November or now just in Gaza. This has impacted a small little village in a part of Jenin district, which is maybe 99% of the reader never heard about that village. So to show it's a story happening every day. It's everyday life for Palestinian families since 1948, who are losing and gaining and losing and gaining. So for me, it's one family went through a lot. And I always feel like the lucky, fortunate one, and I want to keep telling it. And it's just I want everybody to learn who's Iyad and who's Maida and Yusuf and who's Abu Yusuf and who is Serene and what's her role in that family. At the same time, it will bring a lot of people to, I don't want to say sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, call for justice for us, because it just, this is, if we're around like 13 and a half million, almost 14 million Palestinians around the world. I think each one has a story. I don't want to say similar, but has a story living or under the occupation and how even the occupation impacted them. So for me, my first hope is more people reading it, more people understand the resistance, understand, like you talked about the collaborator. There's so many of them were innocent. This is a small community, small village, people basically accusation surface, and some people take it seriously and a matter to their hand, and some people ignore it. And during that time, There is so many people who are lost. What's right? What's wrong? What's true? What's false? And like you said, there is so many story. I would love have to have an answer about it until now. Do you think I don't, I'm not rested? I did not even rest that the book is out. There is so many questions is not answered for me about Iyad and about Iyad Bath and about Iyad wife and what happened to him and all of those details. But in the end, it's a story has to be told, and hopefully everybody will get the chance to read it and ask so many questions and learn so much about the Palestinian and become more supporter for Palestine to become independence. Palestinians have the right to return. Palestinians have the right to their homes, which is prisoners have the right to be free. We calling for more than 10,000 Palestinian young kids and women and people who spend years in their, of their life in prison. And Iyad is nothing compared to others. And hopefully that you're saying like political science views, those students are the future of the country. Those your students are the one day they're the future of this country, which has unlimited support to one side of the conflict and ignoring the other side of the conflict. And just those students, by learning it and telling the story, I'm telling my story. Hopefully, my dream is they keep telling my story. So they read it and pass it to others and others, to their children, to their family, to their brother, to their sisters, which is like one of my students from 11 years ago just texted me. She read the book and she just passed it to her sister and her sister husband. And that's why I wanted more people like, yeah, to pass it to generation and generation. And people remember us that we're adult in that map and we have a story to tell. And it's a true story. That's what is important. It's a true story to a true people who live and suffer and struggled. And this is the good and the bad and the ugly of the story. Yeah.
Well, we've been speaking. we've been speaking with Ezrin Sawala and Sami Hermez. After the break, we'll be back to speak some more with Sami Hermez. This is Mark Lynch, the Political Science Podcast, and we're back with Sami Hermez. And I wanted to ask you, Sami, you teach at Northwestern University in Qatar, and you're teaching in Doha at a time, you know, since October 7th, with the Israeli war on Gaza and kind of intense, you know, the horrors on the screen every day. And your students, how are they responding to this? What's it like teaching Middle East anthropology, communications, et cetera, at a time when all of this is happening?
Yeah, it's hard to focus on anything, I have to say. I think being in Doha at this time, I have to thank my lucky stars, I think. I feel I was in the US a month ago. I feel like it's the twilight zone over there, and sort of the repression and what you can and can't say. And so being here on one hand is a kind of probably would for you, you know, for someone coming from the US would feel like a breath of fresh air. So, you know, when things happened, of course, I think in my class, I shifted to sort of talking about Palestine in the classroom, and also listening to students. So we have students who have lost many family members. We have students who have lost, you know, parents, students who have lost cousins, and so on. And so the mood, especially in, you know, the first few months, was terrible, right? And it was hard for, you know, you feel like people are walking around as like shadows of themselves, but at the same time, it's an environment where, you know, you could say what you want to say, right? You can, and people understand some of the, you know, the basics, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you kind of can take the conversation further, right? Of where we want to go, or how, how do you think about Zionism moving forward? And so, but at the same time, I mean, I keep sort of going back and forth. There is also a sense of complacency here in Doha, in the sense that, like, life goes on, and but except you're so proximate to there. There is a sense that the government is doing quite a bit in terms of, mediation and trying. There's Jazeera that's here, and I was called on Al Jazeera to comment on the news multiple times, and you feel like the narrative is being held together in ways that Doha's a part of that. It's not the UAE and it's not the US. But then it also makes, but then at the same time, you don't have that room to protest, for example, right? And so I think for our students, especially, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, that sense of, being able to go out and protest and confront and stuff, they don't have that, right? Who are you going to protest? What are your demands? And so on. So there are those kind of contradictions, I guess.
Now, your first book was on Lebanon and about the war is coming, I think was the title, but this idea of living on the edge of war and not war and the constant threat of violence. But of course, Lebanon is currently, it's not quite at war yet, but it's getting there. And I'm curious, like, your thoughts on kind of how people are experiencing. I don't know how in contact you are with Lebanon right now, but how you see that experience through the lens of your earlier work.
Yeah, I mean, I always say I feel like I should probably revisit the book and revisit the part two of, like, the arguments and how they kind of fit into what's happening today. And I think they're extremely relevant. I do think that Lebanon is at war, and part of the issue, which actually comes up at some point, if I recall, in the book, is that there's a way in which, if it's not if hurting Beirut, if the bombs aren't falling in Beirut, it's not a war, right? So when there's a war in the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp in the north, near Tripoli, or when people and factions in Tripoli are fighting each other, that's not Lebanon at war. That's Tripoli, or that's the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp, even though there's constant shelling and whatnot. And similarly now, there's fighting in the south. There's over 500 people who have been killed in the last 6 months in Lebanon. There's constant bombing both sides, right? Meaning, the Lebanese are getting shelled, but also Hezbollah are attacking targets in Palestine. And so there is, I think, this sense that if it's not, if the bombs aren't landing in Beirut, then it's not a war yet. Or if it's not total destruction of Lebanon or Beirut, it's not a war yet. So I think that sort of narrative also, can be used for and against Hezbollah, in the sense that can be used for Hezbollah by saying that, they're being responsible and they're not, they haven't opened up a whole all-out war. But it can be used against them by saying, oh, look, they're letting the resistance in Palestine to fend for itself when they're not engaged. And so there's that. The other part of this, of your question, is how people in Lebanon, I think, people in Lebanon are basically, as they don't feel like they're at war, right? And when I say people in Lebanon, obviously I mean people in Beirut and north of Beirut, and so the country, and not the south, right? Is that you go to Beirut today, and I guarantee you this weekend there are probably, tens of good parties. And this is not just, Lebanon experiencing a war, but it's also an economic crisis that we're still in. But yet, I was there in the winter. You wouldn't know it, right? That there's anything going on. And in fact, in Doha, you can feel it more, because there's a ton of Palestinian flags. And there's a lot more sort of expression of solidarity, whereas in Lebanon, I think people feel like we're in this with the Palestinians. We're fighting this war too. What are we gonna do, right? We have to live, and we just kind of, go out and do our thing.
In the context of the other project that we were doing together, you've made an argument about against methodological nationalism, where, if I understood it correctly, you'd say it's wrong to think about Palestine is at war, Lebanon is not at war, Syria is at war, but Jordan is not at war, but rather to think about this in a broader Levantine context of deeply interconnected conflicts. Does that still make sense to you?
Yeah, very, very much so. I think and I've been thinking about it a lot, in fact, that this work on sort of warscapes and methodological nationalism, and thinking about how it's one war, in the sense that, even October 7, what you see what happened is, immediately Lebanon is pulled in, right? But even more so is understanding what Hezbollah is fighting for, and what, forget Hezbollah, but what are the people who back that kind of struggle, what are they asking for? And that it's not just about Palestine or just about Lebanon, that I think there's so much interconnected. You see the Jordanians now protesting, and that this isn't something that just affects Gaza, it affects us all. And thinking of this as, we're forced to think of them across national borders because of these borders, but actually to try to think of them as more porous. And, that this sort of segues into what I've been thinking of since, you actually pushed me to think of the warscape in this context, as I've actually started to think, in a sort of future-oriented manner, thinking of like anthropology of the future, in the sense of what does it look like to think of these lands as one, not just one warscape, but as one sort of people living in this larger land where borders don't exist anymore. I've been thinking quite a bit since maybe last April, or so, or May, of how do we imagine this landscape, as one? Think of, like, what would post-liberation look like? What would people, how would life and everyday life look like in this land post-liberation, right? And so it's sort of, I've been thinking a lot in this kind of an imaginary way, in some ways building from this kind of narrative nonfiction, but rather than thinking historically, thinking towards the future, and that we sort of need creative solutions, but also that I think we live in a time where people don't really want manifestos and ideologies, but maybe want to think through these things through stories, and think of the politics through stories, and what would this mean for Jews in this land? What would it mean for Armenians? And what would it mean for Shia or whoever, right?
That's really interesting. And I think for a last question, I kind of want to ask you a version of the same question we ended on with Shireen, which is now Shireen, I asked, kind of what does she want general people to take away from the book? What should they learn about Palestine? But you wear two hats, right? You wrote this narrative nonfiction. You're also a professional anthropologist. And so when you're thinking about how academic colleagues will read this book, whether anthropologists, political scientists, whatever, what do you hope they take away from it? I mean, from this exercise in telling the story of Palestine this way.
Yeah, I think there's two things. I think method and authorship. So on one hand, I do think of this as experimental ethnography, if you like. So, and I, with my ethnographer's hat or anthropology hat, I would like people to sort of read this in academic settings with a kind of thought towards experimental ethnography and what is it mean to tell a story in a different in this different way, but then also how do you work with your interlocutors and authorship, and Serena and I struggled with this, and actually I think we continue to struggle with this, and I think I've struggled with this with the press as well, because there's a traditional way of looking at a monograph as like a single authored, right? And what does it mean for someone to tell their story orally, right? They're an author as well, but there was this you're not recognized as an author in the same way, right? Because you're not doing the writing. And so we've struggled with this. It's also I think Serena and I have discussed it, and I think like the whole even on the cover, like my name is bigger, right? And which maybe you didn't notice, right? And so
I
and
just
this
noticed
is
now, yeah.
right, and this is and the press had a kind of way of thinking about this, and they have, right, they're in charge of the cover, right? As much as we gave feedback, but they're ultimately in charge of the cover, and so there's a way of that they think of this in authorship. But I think from an anthropological point of view, and that I'm still working, even though the book is done, I think I'm still working through these issues, is that how do you work with your interlocutor, and in a way where with anthropology we usually we go there, we go somewhere, we research, and then we come back and we write. And as much as we care about those people and whatnot, it's they're there, we're here, we go off and do, right? And this is a different project. I mean, Serena and I have been doing this for 20 years. We're like family. So it's a different relationship, right? And I think, I want future anthropologists or ethnographers to sort of really think through that and what that the ethics of that means, and giving, what does voice mean with your interlocutor, and yeah,
One of the things
I
which
could go on. I mean,
well, in political science, there's this like one of the most devastating critiques that you'll hear people make. Say you're a Jordanian and you read a book of political science about Jordan, and you say, I don't recognize my country in this. This is not what's happening. This is just not really what's going on. And I think that the method that the two of you put together kind of ensures that won't happen. That which in a kind of interesting way.
what's funny you say that. Just today, Celine sent me pictures of her. Is it your? I think your cousin, someone from the.
Akram, he's from Kfar Rae, who made it to Stanford University, and
Yeah.
he
So
went
he.
back to Kfar Rae and took a picture with the book in front of the house and the village with the sunset. I did not tell Sammy. I cried. I opened that pictures and I just start crying. Like it made
It's
it to Kfar Rae.
so one of the things that I was thinking when I saw that is, obviously Celine, she worked on this book and was invested in, and she was it's very close to her, so she's hopefully she likes it at the end, because she worked so closely in the writing phase. And so, but this person is from the village, and he's reading it now, and I'm really curious to see how, what his, if he will feel like exactly what you said, like, oh, this is not us, right? Or if he's going to be like, oh, wow, you did this, a great
Fascinating.
service. Like I do, I am a bit haunted by this wanting to do justice to her family, but also to the village, and just, in general. So, and that's a, that's tough.
Well, this has been really fascinating. Again, a bit of a departure from the kind of books we usually talk about on the Middle East Political Science podcast, but one that I learned a lot from and really enjoyed reading. I want to thank Sami Hermes and Serin Swale for joining us. And thanks for listening to the Middle East Political Science podcast.